Okay, there we go.
We're getting proper
We're getting the
indications.
signal, so let's
Good.
talk about the bank.
Okay, well, there's a couple of things I'd like to say in the beginning. One, when I'm thinking about, you asked me to be thinking about some of the interesting people that I have had contact with because of the bank, and I have had some. I said to myself, well, I've got to be careful because if I tell stories, they've got to be about people that are no longer with us.
Precisely. By the way,
at least if they're identified, they got to be people that are no longer here, and I've done that. So,
excuse me one
yeah.
minute. It's the Salisbury Bank and Trust we're talking about, not just the bank, although that's what we call it.
That's true. Well, I should have been certain to say that myself, but you're quite correct. It is the Salisbury Bank and Trust Company, although that is only its current name. It's had a number of names in the past, and I will give you some very brief, because all of this information has been published and is available in other places, so I'm sure it's not the kind of thing you want to have a repeat on. But the original bank was organized in 1848, and at that time was called the Salisbury Savings Society. And it was strictly a savings bank. And started off very modestly, and as I say, there's a lot of. I was dug out some of this the Salisbury Savings mm-hmm. Society. There's a sketch, a historical sketch that was published by the society in 1907, going back to when it started 1848, and tell some interesting stories about it. But again, I could read that to you, but anybody.
Do you think Jenny Moskowitz has got it?
I imagine she does, but I would certainly show it to her. And if she doesn't, she can have it. And there's another little brochure in 1948. The Salisbury Bank Trust Company celebrated 100 years of Salisbury banking, because that was 100 years from 1848. But anyhow, the Salisbury Savings Society operated in various buildings, started down on Farnham Road in the house that Ken Atho used to live in, or at least that house used to be up on the green, which is now just a green. And then the bank building was built, I can't remember exactly when, but sometime in the late 1800s, on top of the hill where the Wagner McNeil insurance office is now. And that's the building that I knew when I came to the bank. That savings society operated and moved into that building. And then in 1874, the town, I guess, felt the need for a commercial, quote, commercial bank, which would make business loans and that sort of thing. The Savings Society basically took people's savings and made mortgage loans for houses and would never give a business loan or anything like that. So that need was filled by Mr. Robbins and Mr. Burrell, who formed a Robbins, Burrell and Company, which was a private commercial bank, and it operated out of the same building. As a matter of fact, they had two cash drawers, and there were two windows side by side. One window was the Robbins, Burrell and Company, the commercial bank, and the other window was the Salisbury Savings Society. And they operated very congenially that way for from 1874 until 1925, at which time they decided this was silly, they might better get married. So they did merge and become, that's where the name Salisbury Bank Trust Company started. It was in 1925, and it was a result of the merger of those two banks. And interestingly, to me at least, that was the first merger of a commercial and savings bank in the United States. And the only reason I know that is because even when I was in the bank in the 50s, we occasionally would get a call or a letter from somebody wanting to get copies of our files of how we accomplished that merger, because it was the first time it had ever been done. Apparently it was fairly unusual for a commercial bank and a savings bank to merge. Commercial banks and savings banks, it's hard to distinguish them nowadays, but through most of history, commercial banks were one animal and savings banks were another, and they really not only did not, they didn't really, they weren't friendly to one another. I mean, there were commercial bank associations and savings bank associations. They never talked to one another. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of an unusual thing, and Salisbury Bank was the first in the United States to do that. That's a brief history of the bank. My history with it starts in 1954. And I've already touched on why I got into the bank, but basically, when I got out of the service, I wanted to stay here in Lakeville, and and Zach Candy, at that time was the no, he wasn't the treasurer. He was working. I guess he was just a teller at the bank. And I knew Zach, and we were friendly. And he told me one day, he says, you know, we're looking for a teller at the bank. So if it's anything you'd be interested in. At that point, I was really just adrift. I was interviewing for jobs various places around, none of them in Lakeville or Salisbury. So I decided to have a shot at it. And I did, and I liked it, and I stayed. So it was sort of accidental me getting into the banking business, though, you know, certainly my training at Cornell, though it was specialized to the hotel business, there were accounting courses, and it was a business management course. So it wasn't entirely lost in terms of what I was going to do for the rest of my life. At the time, so I went in, and I wasn't even a teller, I guess, in the beginning. I think I worked in the bookkeeping department for a few weeks, sorting checks. And with a meteoric rise, I was a teller within a few weeks. And enjoyed that. There were, I think at the time, just as a matter of contrast, now the bank at that time had total assets of approximately $5 million. Today, it's about $175 million. So, of course, they're inflated dollars, so the difference is not as great as it might first appear, but it was a very small institution. I think there were a total of 8 employees, where now there are about 75. But it was a very congenial group, and it's tempting to look nostalgically back on those days as better days. I'm not sure they were always better, but it was Harry Bellini was the president. Harry had been with the bank forever. He was a sort of a local boy. He wasn't born in Lakeville, but I think he was born in Winsted, maybe. And he graduated from Winsted High School and came right to work at the bank out of high school when he was 17 years old, and stayed and ultimately became the president. And he was the president when I got there. The bank was very quaint. I remember with some embarrassment one day, quaint to the extent that when you walked in, it had the mahogany woodwork and the brass grills and all that stuff.
It was charming.
Yeah, right. Mm. And I can remember once in later years, while we were still there, some person from California was visiting and walked into the bank and just was ecstatic. Said, oh, what a quaint, beautiful little bank. And then, you know, in California, there probably never was a bank like that, or at least not in the 50s. So there were a lot of differences about banking in those days. An example, we paid on savings, we paid 3% up to $5,000. Any money over between $5,000 and $10,000, you got 1.5%. Anything over $10,000, you got a half of 1%. Now, I've never been able to figure out what the rationale was for that. I mean, talk about discouraging deposits. I think there was a fear of having a concentration of money in a single person's account. In other words, if somebody got $15,000 and decided to take it out, I mean, this might be a trauma for the bank. And going along with that, I remember getting instructed early on that if anybody came in and wanted to deposit more than $1,000 in a savings account, we were not to accept it, but send them in to see Harry. And Harry would then interview these people and find out what their intentions were.
Oh, shuck.
No kidding. They were serious about it. In other words, he would question them as to what they intended to do with this money. I mean, if they were just going to put it in there for a month and then take it out and do something else, he wasn't going to take it. And I don't know whether he elicited a promise or a pledge or whatever from these people that they were going to leave it there for a minimum amount of time. But that was the rule. Anybody that wanted to deposit more than $1,000 had to go see Harry, and he would decide whether or not to accept it. Also, on the other side of the coin, on mortgage loans, we would not entertain an application for a mortgage if it was in excess of $5,000. That was the biggest mortgage we could make. Well, of course, in 54, I mean, after all, my first house I paid $12,000 for, so I might have been able to get a mortgage the bank, I don't know, but I ended up getting a GI mortgage. But that was just to give you an idea of how things have changed in that regard. Also, and it hits me every once in a while, even since I've been out of the bank actively, the mortgage application process is ever so much more complicated. The mortgage application forms, it's a packet of 8.5 by 14 pieces of paper and probably 10 deep with the various disclosure statements, commitment forms, blah, blah, all title searches. When I went to the bank, our mortgage application form was one piece of paper, and it wasn't even a full 8.5 by 11 sheet. It was about 8.5 by 8, and it had about 10 lines on it. And you could fill one of those out in about 5 minutes. And in addition to that, if you were on good terms with your attorney, you could come in the morning and fill out your mortgage application, and you could have your money that afternoon. Now, try to do that today, Jody. even when I left the bank, you could get a mortgage in a few days, but now it's at least 2 or 3 weeks before you can get a mortgage.
If you can get one.
Right. So, things have changed a lot. In those days, made what we now, and we still talk about this in the banking business, character loans. In other words, a loan that really has nothing to do with the financial condition of the borrower, but based on their character and your knowledge that they are people that are going to pay back or die. I mean, they're going to pay. And for a great many years, almost all of our loans were character loans. The bank was smaller. We knew the people. They were not people from outside the community. Most of them were people that were in the community that had been there for years, had been doing business with the bank for years. They were used to being able to walk into the bank and say, I need a couple thousand dollars. And we'd say, here, sign here. I'll fill it out and put the money in your account. I mean, it was that quick. They would come in and sign their name and leave you to do the paperwork and put the money in their account. For most of the years when I was in the bank, I kept at home blank note forms of all kinds because I have had calls on a Sunday from a working person that couldn't get to say, you know, I need some money, and they would come to the house, sign a note in blank, and say, you know, put the money in my account on Monday. So you can't do business that way anymore, unfortunately, but in a lot of ways that kind of relationship with your customers is what built the bank, and I can only hope that enough of that stays with the bank so that it will continue to be successful, because many times we've seen it in the past to worry about competition coming into the area where, like, the Chase Bank takes over the old Millard National Bank that used to be a bank just like Salisbury Bank. And some of the old farmers in the Millerton area for years have been going into Millerton National Bank in springtime when they needed their crop loan or whatever, and they'd walk in. Zach used to work there, and they'd say, Zach, you know, I need $5,000. Okay, just sign this note, and they got the money. Well, when the Chase Bank went in there, no way, they couldn't do that anymore. And they had forms to fill out. They wanted to see financial statements. And you can imagine how that rankled those people that have been doing business, and consequently a lot of that business came over to us. We got a lot of business as a result of that. So we did not feel threatened by these large banks coming in. Contrary, they made our business bigger.
Don't you think that the two banks, I'm trying to think, National Iron, I thought, oh boy, that's tough, and then you'd have Litchfield coming in. It doesn't seem to bother Salisbury Bank at all.
Well, you should mention that, because when that first started happening, you know, we didn't get panicky, but I can remember when Litchfield was the first one to come in here,
mm-hmm.
and Harry Bellini was almost in a panic, and he said, you know, they're going to take half of our business, and so we protested and we fought that, and to no avail, and it happened, and nothing happened. And then when the National Iron wanted to move their main office into our town, we discussed this again, and we said, hey, why spend a lot of money? With the atmosphere, the regulatory atmosphere at that time was, you know, let them branch, and So we said, no, our experience has been that it doesn't seem to affect us, and it never has. I don't know where the money comes from, but it more when another bank comes into the town, more money comes out of the woodwork someplace.
Interesting.
So,
it's interesting that poor Millerton Bank has had, what, 3 robberies now? 2? You know, right across from Trotta's, and you've only had those poor sappy kids in their Halloween outfits.
Yeah, well, we've had 2 robberies. One completely unsuccessful. We had the money back in 24 hours, and they were caught within hours of, that was the Salisbury branch robbery. The one in Lakeville where they shot through the ceiling, the insurance company paid us on that, but I don't think they ever recovered that money, and they think they caught the guy up in New Hampshire after he was connection with some other bank robberies up there. But the reason they think he's the one that robbed us is because they found in this little cabin he was hiding in bill straps and things with our name on them. So they're just assuming that he was the guy that had taken us. I wanted to, before we get away from the past, tell you a couple more things just to sort of give more of the flavor of how things operated in those days. Soon after I got to the bank in 54, I think it was in 55 or 56, the bank was growing and needed space for the bookkeeping. So they decided to put an addition on the back of the old building up on the top of the hill there. And at that time, Bill Rainsford was on the bank's board, so naturally he got the contract to do that. I suppose today that would somehow bring about some kind of conflict of interest problem, but and he was not only the contractor, but he was the architect. And someday, if you're ever in there, you ought to go in that back room, ask Walt to show you that back room, because it's a fairly good-sized room, but all the windows are these little awning-type windows, and they're right up next to the ceiling. And that was Bill Rainsford's, I can remember it very clearly, Bill Rainsford's design, and he was very clear in why he did that. He said, if you put windows down where people can see out of them, they'll just spend their time looking out the window. So those girls in the bookkeeping room, all they could do is look out and see the sky. They couldn't see anything else because Bill Rainsford thought that might keep them from doing their work. My sister-in-law, Edith Blodgett, Shirley's sister, worked in the bank in the days before Harry Bellini, when a man named Henry Hoadley, was the president who preceded Harry. And Harry's office, and before that Henry Hoadley's office, was off to the easterly corner of the building, somewhat removed from the general banking area. And Edith has often told me that if there was any laughter, if anybody laughed, Mr. Hoadley was out in the bank to find out what was going on. So things were pretty severe in those days. We had the old Boston Ledger. I don't know if you know what that is, but the bank, when I arrived at the bank in 54, the bank's main accounts were on what they call a Boston Ledger, and we had this great counter, and this ledger was probably 3 feet by 2 feet each page, and it had columns and columns and columns, and all the various accounts for the, not individual people's accounts, but all of the general ledger accounts of the bank, of which there might have been 20 or 30, savings, deposits, expenses, interest, and this, various things. But anyhow, that's how the bank balanced itself every day, was using this Boston Ledger. And it was a manual operation. I mean, by hand, you inked, penciled the figures in, and they got inked in after we were proved up. But Earl Vosburgh was the treasurer of the bank when I went there, and he was probably at that time a man in his 60s. And he had been in banking all his life. He was a scrupulously accurate, neat man, somewhat severe, although he had a sense of humor. But when it came down to business, he was business. And so we go through the day, and Earl Vosburgh, being the treasurer, was in charge of the Boston Ledger. And we, all of us minions, would come to him with figures and so forth, and he'd enter them in the ledger. And then the moment of truth would come at the end of the day when you're trying to prove, of course. And Earl Vosburgh, who didn't believe in any machines, I mean, he didn't trust them, he would add these columns of perhaps 30 or 40 figures. And he could do it. I mean, he would take his pencil and he'd start at the top, and he would just, you know, about this speed, he'd just go zipping right down the bottom. carry a number. He could add those figures faster than you could possibly do on an ante machine, and he never made a mistake. As a matter of fact, when Earl got finished his additions and cross footings and all that stuff, and it was out of balance, he'd put on his hat and go home, and he'd say, "You got a mistake somewhere." And he was that confident, and unfortunately, much to the irritation of all of us, he was always right. I mean, we never found him in a mistake. I went, as years went by, and I can't remember when we finally got rid of that Boston Ledger, but I'm sure we must have had it for at least 6 or 8 years after 54, up into the 60s. And I can remember with some sense of shame and embarrassment, I used to go to bank conventions or bank association meetings, and during the break sometime, people would be either having a meal or standing around the bar, and I'd be standing there and I'd hear this conversation going on. A couple old duffers stand and say, "Well, do you remember when we had the old Boston Ledger?" And I would stand there shrinking, saying, "We're still using that Boston Ledger." They were talking like it was ancient history. So now I want to tell you about some interesting people that I met. And in the course of banking, one nice thing, I've always said to people, I'm not really and I truly believe this, I'm not a career banker, because to me the business of banking, just the business of pushing the numbers around, I would consider dull business. It's in a way an easy business, because contrary to a retailer who has to sell things and has to have traffic in and out of their store to survive, the bank operates on the spread, the interest spread. I mean, they take in deposits, pay money for them, and loan them out and get paid money, and there's a spread there. They charge more interest than they pay. So, I mean, in the old days, I can remember on a February morning, in the old bank up on the hill, we would go from 9 o'clock until noontime, and we might have 5 or 6 people come in the bank the whole morning long. Now that's hard to imagine now, but that's what happened. And I remember people saying, "Boy, you guys are in trouble. You know, this is bad." And I would always say to them, "Hey, in a way, it really makes no difference if anybody comes in here, because the spread is still there. The money, it's cranking interest. I mean, even if we don't do anything today, we've earned something." So in that respect, banking is an easy business, although I will say today, obviously, it's not easy anymore, as evidenced by the failure of a lot of banks. But easy, but also, I would say, dull. But the thing that saved the banking business for me is operating in a small town, because you do a lot of things that have nothing to do with banking. You meet people, and you hear their problems, and they may not necessarily be financial problems, which makes it very, very interesting. I mean, it's not a dull business by any means, and it certainly hasn't been for me. I mentioned that, of course, the old building now is the Wagner McNeil office, but when we were up there in that old building, the N.A. McNeil Company, the predecessor, was up overhead, and Charlie Fitz was running that office. Ken Atho was in there, and Ethel Thrall was the secretary. You remember Ethel?
Yes.
Well, this story is to do with Ethel. I was always generally the first person. I'm an early riser anyhow, and I found I could get my best work done before the bank opened, so I very often would be at the bank no later than 8 o'clock, and sometimes before that. And Ethel Thrall was the early bird in the N.A. McNeil office. She came in and opened things up and so forth. We had a problem with bats in that building. It's an old, old building, and it had lots of holes in it, and the attic was full of bats. As a matter of fact, we had a huge pile of bat guano that I was kept track of, because I threatened to bag it up in baggies and sell it for fertilizer, but I never did do that. It was one of my lost opportunities, I guess. But anyhow, one morning, I was in the bank, and Ethel came in the side door, and I could hear her going up the stairs. And then there was this god-awful shriek. I ran upstairs. I didn't know what had happened. But Ethel, the key to the office door was apparently kept in the attic stairwell, hanging on a little hook. You know it's coming, don't you, Jody? And Ethel this morning had opened, and she never looked, she just opened up the door and reached around to grab the key. Well, of course, this time there happened to be a bat hanging off of the hook. Well, that was an experience Ethel didn't get over for quite a long time. I think she moved the place where she kept the key and never ventured into that attic stairwell again. We've had a lot in the news lately about the house and the house bank and the gentleman drawing checks with the knowledge there were no funds to cover until their paycheck came in or whatever. And I got to say, in the early days when I was in the bank, I was quite impressed with how loose and sloppy things were in that regard. And one particular guy comes into mind, and I'm sure he must be dead, and his name wouldn't mean anything anyhow, but this guy, he didn't live in Lakeville. I think he lived possibly in Amenia or Sharon, and I really can't recall even what his business was, but I do remember as a teller, I was told that this was going to happen, and every day at 2:30, this gentleman came into the bank to see what checks he had in against his account that day, and he very rarely had enough money to cover them. And we'd give him the number, and he would disappear. And at 3:05, he was back with cash to cover those checks. And this went on for years. And we were, in retrospect, foolish to even allow it to happen, but it's one of those things. And what he was doing, of course, we soon, if anybody had taken the trouble to figure it out, would have figured it out pretty easily. He was simply going, he had accounts in a lot of banks around here. And he was, and whether the guy was able to ever do any business, whatever his business was, I never knew, because he certainly had to spend part of every afternoon ripping around. So, because he'd leave, for instance, if he came into our bank and he needed $100 to cover his checks, he would zip down to the Sharon Bank, and where he also had an account, and cash a check on us and bring the $100 up to cover our check. And of course, you know, in those days, it took checks sometimes 4 or 5 days a week to clear. So he had a lot of balls in the air all the time. And except for the scale, it makes these guys in Congress look like pikers. But that activity is old as the hills. I suspect it's been going on ever since banks existed. We also, I can mention this guy's name, old Jim Meehan, a farmer who's since departed, but Jim used to be a good customer of the bank, but the girls in the teller line just couldn't stand him, because Jim he came to the bank in his barn clothes. I mean, he never changed his clothes. Oh, I won't say he never changed his clothes, but he never changed his clothes to come to the bank during banking hours. He came right out of the barn, and in the wintertime, particularly, he had a habit. Now, whether he was, I think this was as he was getting older, and perhaps the effort of getting into the bank was tiring to him, so he would come in and sit on one of the radiators.
Oh!
For a few minutes before he did his business, and the smell of ripe silage would just fill the bank. And that was pretty hard to take.
Was he Mary Meehan Finney's brother?
Yes. Yeah, he was a farmer all his life, and a town, and a character. Nice guy, but he sure didn't smell good. I started as a sorting checks, and then I got to be a teller, and then eventually I got to be a loan officer, and that was a pretty awesome experience, because of course then you really have some responsibility, and you're lending other people's money out, and you have to be hope that you're going to get it back. But and I had a desk by the side window. It's a side street that runs from 41 down to
Allen Street.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And I came in one morning to find a Coke bottle in my chair. And of course, the windows were those great big pane windows, and it was right by, and someone had gone by in the night and heaved a Coke bottle through the window into my chair. And I spent the next few minutes trying to figure out who I had turned down for a loan. Anytime in the last week, I never came to any conclusions. Do you remember somebody, the gal named Lavender Lovell?
Oh,
Who doesn't?
of course.
I think most people that have been here at any time at all knew Lavender. I met Lavender at the bank when she, you do, one thing about banking, you do meet people about as soon as they come into town. And I had the pleasure of opening Lavender Lovell's account for her. And Lavender, for those who didn't know her, of course, was a cherubic woman with, to be charitable, I shouldn't say this, I suppose, but I don't think her hair was natural, but it was very blonde and very outspoken person. And she, and I doubt her real name was Lavender, but she had adopted that name. And the color, as you know, was certainly her favorite color. And I, in talking with her to open the account, of course, one of the things I had to do was order her a checkbook. And so, and you know, what color? At that point, I noticed that she had lavender nail polish on, and her clothing was lavender, and or at least it was highlighted with lavender, and her pen wrote with lavender ink. So naturally, I shouldn't have been surprised when she said, well, I want a lavender checkbook. Well, we dealt with a number of companies that printed checks in those days, and I got all the catalogs out, and we searched and searched through all the catalogs, and there was not a single company that made a lavender check. Now, I can't remember now what she finally settled for, but it was probably something as close to lavender as we could get. And I'm sure it didn't satisfy her. She, nothing to do with banking, but of course she raised English bulldogs, ugly dogs, but apparently quite favored in breeding circles or what have you. And she traveled to dog shows all over the country and was quite successful. And I think she really, and she, the house that she bought up on the Intermountain Road that she built a huge addition on, and she had dog runs built there that were air conditioned, and she loved her dogs. And of course, all of her bed sheets that were hanging, all of her laundry that hung out in the line was always lavender. That the house itself had lavender shutters. I mean, it was just goes on and on. But she needed a station wagon to travel to these shows with her dogs and so forth. And she went to Morgan Motors to order a new Ford station wagon. And Morgan, I guess, talked about what features she wanted and so on and so forth. So when it got to the end of it, he said, well, what color? Of course, I'm sure at that point he probably knew what to expect. And Lavender had a sweater over her arm, and she threw it on his desk and said, this is the color I want the car. And apparently, I didn't know this, but apparently you can get any color car you want if you're willing to pay for it. And that's what Morgan said to her. He said, well, you can have it this color if you like. It'll cost you $400 extra. Today, probably, it would cost you $2,000 extra. She said, I don't care. That's the color I want. And that's the color she got. She got this lavender station wagon to travel to various, and to give you an idea of what kind of a character Lavender was, she had a lot of trouble with that car. It had an automatic transmission, and she hadn't had it very long before the transmission went out or didn't act correctly. And she took it to Morgan, and he did warranty work on it, and it kept going out. And anyhow, to make a long story short, she just had all kinds of trouble, to the point where she was exasperated, and Morgan was not able to get much cooperation out of the Ford Motor Company on this thing. He thought that she ought to have a new transmission or a new car or something, but Ford Motor Company was resisting. So Lavender went out and got some extra signs and had them mounted on this car. Ford is a lemon, I mean, just very negative advertising. And in deference to Morgan, who she really liked, she had a little sign on the back of the car that said, Morgan Motors OK. And she drove around the country in this car. Well, that would be bad enough. But she wasn't satisfied. She wanted to get some action. She happened to be going to Detroit for a dog show. So she called a newspaper in Detroit before going and explained the situation and said that she was going to the Ford Motor Company with this car. And of course, you know, the newspapers thought this was great. So they were there with their photographers. And as Lavender drove up in front of the main plant in this car, plastered with these not very complimentary signs, She told me a lot of the story herself after she got back, and some unctuous vice president came out and was very gracious and said, oh, and listened to her story and said, well, now, Mrs. Lovell, we're very, very sorry. I'm sure this has all been a great misunderstanding. Why don't you leave your car here with us today, and we're going to take you into the city and wine and dine you, and they will put a brand new transmission in your car while you're here. No charge. Fine. So Lavender went and had a nice luncheon and was wined and dined by Ford Motor Company executives. Came back in the afternoon. They rolled her car out, had a brand new transmission in it. She thanked him very much, and this man said, well, I assume that now you will, they hadn't taken the signs off the cars, off the car, and she said, I assume you're going to take your signs off. She said, well, I will when Ford Motor Company reimburses me for the 700 and some odd dollars that I've paid to rent a car while this car was out of commission with its transmission. And I guess Ford Motor Company had gone as far as they're going to go, and they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. I guess it wasn't their policy at the time. So she said, well, then the signs stay on, and she drove off. So that was Lavender.
That's a good story.
She was a character.
She was indeed.
She was really a good-hearted person, a very good-hearted person, and but she was eccentric. One of my favorite other experiences as a bank employee occurred, and I can't remember the year this happened, but we have a trust department, always had a trust department, and Annie Wasaki, I don't know if you remember Annie Wasaki. Annie Wasaki, well, she's a relative. She was an aunt of Dick McHugh's. And she and her husband, Joe, lived in, let's see, where Sunflower is now. It used to be the Village Restaurant or whatever.
Blue Room.
The Blue Room. The next house beyond that, was a small little house in there. And that was owned by Annie Wasaki. As a matter of fact, Annie was, in a way, a sort of a slumlord of Lakeville, because she owned about four or five houses in that whole area back there where now Peter Gott is, and they were generally pretty tumble-down places, but she rented them to people that didn't pay much rent, and the people in town really thought she was probably rich, that she just chose to live as a derelict, which she looked like a derelict. I mean, she walked around in rags, and Joe was in rags, and they certainly seemed to be very, very poor. They never had a car. I remember when Annie used to go shopping, she used to shop in Millerton. And Joe had a wheelbarrow. And this was a sight you would often see. The two of them, and they would walk to Millerton to do the grocery shopping. And the groceries would go in the wheelbarrow, and then they would walk back home. And Annie was a rotund woman. Joe was looked like Ichabod Crane. He was just as skinny as a rail. Are we running out of tape
yet? No, you're fine.
And it used to be quite a sight because Annie would stride right along. And Joe would have to sort of run and stumble to try to keep up with her. He never could. I mean, when you pass them on 44 going into Millard, you'd see, first you come upon Joe loping along with this wheelbarrow, and then 100 yards ahead would be Annie. And that has really nothing to do with the story, but that's just to sort of give you a picture of what Annie was like. And they lived in this house, two doors from the Lakeville Post Office, mind you. And Joe died first, and I don't know the circumstances surrounding that, except that he froze to death. I have to think that either he was not in the house at the time, but I never heard much about that story. But then Annie subsequently died, and they had no heat in the house, apparently, because in the wintertime, Annie would, you'd see her quite a lot in the post office or the bank, she was quite serious churchgoer. She was in the Catholic Church, and she'd go up and stay in the church to stay warm. Suddenly, Annie was not appearing, and for about a week, nobody saw Annie. Well, then they finally decided they better go in the house, and Annie was dead, and she had frozen to death in the house. There was no heat. There was no electricity. There was no operative plumbing. Do you remember the story of the Collier brothers in New York? Okay, well, this was the Collier brothers, only on a lesser economic scale, but it was the same thing. No trash, I don't think, had been taken out of the house for years. You walked in aisles through the rooms, and the trash was up waist or shoulder height all around you, filling the rooms. So there were just little passageways. Well, how the bank, or how I got involved, or how the bank got involved, was there was no will that anybody could find. So the court, probate court, appointed the Salisbury Bank as administrator of her estate. Again, there was this general feeling that, in spite of all this, that there was money. And as a matter of fact, there was money. We knew Annie had savings accounts with the bank of substantial amounts. She really didn't need to live the way she lived. We knew that, and at least the bank people knew that. So as administrators, it was our responsibility to go in and look for assets, et cetera, et cetera. So I got being a junior officer of the bank, I got appointed to do that job. And it took 3 or 4 days to go through the house. We hired Ernie Garns, and he got some men. He backed his truck up to the front porch of the house. And the first day we went, and there was a distant relative from Waterbury came up, and I'm sure he thought there was going to be all kinds. So he wanted to be there, make sure that, you know, the bank was going to be honest about this and so forth, and to see, get a first glimpse of this fortune that we're going to find in this house. So we opened the front door and got on the oldest clothes that I had. We got on our hands and knees and started going, well, we started standing up, eventually got on our hands and knees as these piles got down to the floor, and we just look at things to see if there's anything of value, push it behind us. Ernie's men were behind us with shovels. They'd shovel into barrels, take the barrels out and dump them into this truck, and then he'd take loads to the dump. Well, it took 3 days to get through the house doing this. Every night when I went home, of course, Shirley would meet me at the back door, and I'd take off my clothes and hand them in through the door, and she'd drop them in the washing machine. Suffice to say, we never found any money. I mean, there were people who were sure that we should tear the walls down and everything, that there must be money still. We did, we found coins on the floor, just in amongst the trash. Indian head pennies. I mean, old coins that had obviously been there since the days when those things were circulating freely. We ended up with a 3-gallon bucket of pennies and a few nickels. And I think in a moldy old wallet in a jacket hanging in a closet upstairs, we found $20 worth of $5 bills, and they were the old big bills. Now, all this was 2 doors from the post office in Lakeville, mind you. Fortunately, it was February and it was cold. I can't imagine what it would have been like in the summertime. Annie loved cats, and when her cats died, she put them in cardboard boxes and put them down cellar. And we found like 6 or 8 cardboard boxes with cats, starting from skeletal remains to just, you know, rotting remains of cats in the cellar. So this was, we finally got through the house, and it was an experience that I'll never forget. But this was all in the line of duty for a junior bank officer. We eventually settled our estate. We eventually sold the houses. Victor Clark bought them all, I think, for $24,000 or something like that. They were, I thought he paid a pretty good price for them, actually, because they all had to be rebuilt. The house, Annie's house that was so horrible, has been refurbished and is a nice little apartment house now. And I think Victor Clark still owns it, but.
Oh, Jack, that's marvelous. We're coming to the end of the tape. Shall I put another one in?
No, I think that's about all I had to say, unless you have some questions.
No, thank you very much.
You're welcome.